From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our Rock Gods of Rock series with some legends of classic rock. We'll climb the stairway to heaven, every inch of it. Then it's love in an elevator on the way down. First, we get the let out with Robert Plant. The Led Zeppelin frontman tells us what, if anything, he meant by, if there's a bustle in your hedgerow, don't be alarmed now. Then, dudes who look like ladies, Steven Tyler and Joe Perry of Aerosmith, talk about androgyny, drugs, and rock and roll. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tune up your fresh air guitar because this is day two of our hard rock and heavy metal series. Our first guest, Robert Plant, almost invented heavy metal singing as the lead singer of Led Zeppelin. Plant also wrote one of the most popular and parodied hard rock ballads, Stairway to Heaven. Led Zeppelin formed in 1968 and broke up in 1980 after the death of drummer John Bonham. Before we hear my 2004 interview with Plant, here he is with Led Zeppelin in 1969. Robert Plant, welcome to Fresh Air. And with Led Zeppelin, you were wailing over some pretty loud music.
Well, that's right. I had to wail. I had no choice, really. The equipment was pretty inferior in those days. And for PAs, the actual public address system at gigs was... I mean, I remember one night in Zeppelin, we played Columbus, Ohio, the university, with, I think, Jose Feliciano. And the PA was actually a cluster of speakers right up in the apex of the room. It was a circular building with the statutory 60s students sitting around, looking suitably astonished or vacant or whatever it was. And the PA was miles up in the air, and there was no chance on earth that the voice could project. Mm-hmm. So I did have to kick in a lot throughout those early days. I think it was not until about 1970 that Led Zeppelin actually purchased a PA, or rather, I purchased the PA because I was a singer. And then I made John Bonham pay some of it because he was the drummer. And we used two overhead microphones, a bass drum and a snare mic. So I said, well, you'd use four times more microphones than I do. As it happened, we reached an amicable solution as far as the cost of things.
How come you still have a voice after singing that loud for so long?
Oh, because it's all about dynamics. And it's also all about, with technique, the last thing in the world that you can do is just blast like crazy. You have to work your way into a tour as you work your way into an evening of singing. You have to take it steady to begin with, make sure that, if you can, that the introduction of the show is kind to you. That wasn't always the case in Led Zepp, but I mean, I've been in dressing rooms with lots of musicians where the singers go into the toilet and start shrieking at the walls of the toilet, and it's very painful to the casual listener and onlooker, but they seem to think that psychologically is the answer, that it'll make them be much more warmed up when they go on stage. But I prefer Neil Young's way of doing it. You stand in a circle, and it's almost like sort of a kind of cosmic barbershop warm-up where you go, and you do that for about half an hour and have a lie down.
Right, so you actually warm up. Okay.
I don't warm up, but he does, and that's a good way of doing it.
Oh, so you admire it, but don't really do it yourself.
I haven't got time. I have a couple of hot cups of coffee, or a cup of tea, keep quiet, don't talk to anybody, sit in the dark for 5 minutes and then go.
Well, you know, with Led Zeppelin, you started singing a lot of like blues and rhythm and blues influence mm-hmm. material, like, you know, yeah. Muddy Waters, You Shook Me. Did you feel like you had to change your voice when you started singing music inspired, you know, by rhythm and blues?
Not really, because I'd always been, well, that's not always, but from the age of about 14 and a half, in the town where I lived, there was a very strong, healthy movement towards a kind of subculture, a bohemian culture where there were poetry meetings, there was a lot of post-bebop jazz being played and listened to, and blues was, strangely enough, almost mainstream in this particular town, thanks to the art colleges and the students in the area. So I was very familiar with blues, with the idiom of singing. And I'd been singing like that for quite a long time, experimenting. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you listen to a lot of the early English and early American white kids who were involved with blues, Mike Bloomfield, Elvin Bishop, you know, I guess Dave Van Ronk, the people who worked in the coffee houses alongside Dylan in the early 60s, everybody, and Dylan as well, I mean, that first album, Down the Highway and See That My Grave Is Kept Clean, there's some great blues there. And everybody developed a style of their own, which was accommodating and natural, I suppose, restrictions and inabilities. So I was wailing all the time, and I'm sure that half the time it was not as good as it could have been. But, you know, it got better.
Well, one of the things Led Zeppelin did was create a really, like, white version of a music that was based in part on African-American blues.
That's right, yeah. And with varying degrees of success. I mean, I think that on Led Zeppelin 1, there was some fantastic... there was I Can't Quit You, Babe, which is written by Willie Dixon, originally performed by Otis Rush, was a great experiment. It allowed the band to perform and for the personality of the band to come through. And at the same time, it did justice to the original recording.
I can't quit you, babe. So I'm gonna put you down for a while. I guess I got to put you down for a while. Since you messed up my happy home, made me mistreat my only child.
That's Led Zeppelin. Robert Plant will talk more about being the band's lead singer after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Plant. He was the lead singer of Led Zeppelin, one of the most influential bands in the history of hard rock and heavy metal. When we left off, we were talking about how blues musicians influenced the band. This is Led Zeppelin's recording Whole Lotta Love, which is based on a Willie Dixon song. Yeah. Led Zeppelin. My guest is singer Robert Plant. Anything you want to say about your singing on that track?
Well, I just, you know, as a very expressive time, I must say that I always would have liked to have thought that I could create a vocal syncopation and punctuation in as many different ways as possible. My voice is what it is. It's different now to how it was then. But it was punchy and it was joyous. And I guess, you know, my confidence was building by that time. I was 20 years old and I was really trying out all manner of different things. The effects of my childhood and my background, listening to Presley, listening to The Wolf, I tried to put them all into the songs that called for some kind of sexual innuendo or whatever it would be. It was partly blues, partly rock and roll. And it worked.
You were saying that when you started recording, you were shy. And by the time you're in Led Zeppelin, you're singing about, you know, giving her every inch of your love. And so, you know, something had to happen to that shyness on stage. Can you talk about the transformation from, you know, the shy Robert Plant to the much more...
go
ahead.
There is so much innuendo in the blues, and a lot of English musicians were very fired by Robert Johnson, who, to whom we all owe more or less our very existence, I guess. And the innuendo, whether it would be Terraplane Blues, where he was singing about the parallels between his woman and an automobile, or Traveling Riverside Blues, when he's mentioning the famous Squeeze My Lemon line.
Yes, which you made far more famous, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's all there. It's public domain.
Right, right.
The Lemon Song. It's all about the sort of barrel house, bawdy, juke joint aspects of Saturday night music. So I think I was probably still shy, but I was playing in to character, if you like, with these songs, because it was such, Whole Lot of Love was such a kind of funky, sexy piece of music at the time. It had a fantastic lope to it. And taking the original Willie Dixon lyric, you know, you need cooling, I ain't fooling. I mean, that whole idea, it's not talking about cookery lessons or gardening tips. So the whole thing was based on some kind of sexual innuendo, which I think at the age of 20 was okay.
Can you talk a little bit about creating the visual image to go along with this new Robert Plant that was singing these songs that were laced with sexual innuendo?
No, I don't know how many of those songs particularly were aimed in that sort of freeform fashion, but the image has got very little to do with the lyric. It had just got to do with the times and the whole Renaissance clothing, the whole idea of the beautiful clothes and the stuff that the entire wardrobe of movie stars deceased ended up on Sunset Boulevard. There were some beautiful clothes to buy, and they just seemed to be absolutely appropriate. We were all very, very skinny kids,
uh-huh.
You know, 160 pounds and not a lot of muscle, just a lot of energy. So there was a look, and that look was kind of universal, really. It didn't have anything to do with the lyrics. I mean, we could just as easily have been a kind of folk band or, right, you know, another Crosby, Stills and Nash, perhaps, and we still would have been dressing the same way.
Listen, I want to play something for you. I know you must be asked everywhere you go about the lyrics to Stairway to Heaven and what they mean and so on and so on. Did you ever hear the Tiny Tim version of it? I know,
yeah.
Everybody has their most like bizarre version they want to play for you, but do you know the Tiny Tim version?
I have a copy. In fact, I just chucked it away the other day when I was going through some stuff. I think my favorite version is Little Roger and the Goosebumps.
Oh, who were they?
Well, it was a record that was built around the theme for Gilligan's Isle, the TV program. And our lawyer at the time in New York was absolutely furious that anybody should touch this song, this pinnacle of endeavor and artistic creativity with, you know, And I thought it was that and Hairway to Stephen, which was by Deck Chairs Overboard, I think, an Australian punk band, is pretty good. And the song deserved it.
What do you mean by that, as its author?
Well, I mean, because of the pinnacle of and the beauty of the song, sooner or later that has to turn around and swing the other way, like My Way or God Save the Queen, you know. It gets, after a while, it's a great target for pointing a finger of, a sceptical finger in the hoots of derision, and that's what happens. I think Tiny Tim was perhaps one of the more respectful versions.
Oh, it's a great, it's like the lounge version.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
The swing and lounge version. I'm just going to play a little bit of it for our listeners.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, here it is. It's Tiny Tim with a Brave Combo.
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven. And when she gets there, she knows if the stars are closed, with a word she can get what she came for.
Whoa, 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 whoa. And she's buying a stairway to heaven.
So, you know, I'll confess to you that it wasn't until I heard Tiny Tim singing the song that I understood exactly what the lyrics were. And, you know, one of the lines is, if there's a bustle in your hedgerow, don't be alarmed now. It's just a sprig leaf from the May Queen.
Spring clean.
Oh, spring clean as in spring cleaning.
Yeah.
Oh. It's such a proper sounding line.
Well, sprig leaf sounds very suggestive. I can't imagine.
Well, but Maclean and hedgerow and bustle and alarmed, it's so...
yeah. And it's onomatopoeic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What was going through your mind when you wrote this?
I was thinking about the need for a sort of more organic relationship between our generation at the time, who were living faster than fast, and our environment under the... our times were very, I suppose, harum-scarum. And Stairway to Heaven developed as a piece of music that one evening with Jimmy and myself, and that kind of tone, that idiom about returning to nature to look for all the signs, to be aware of our environment yet again, I thought it was an appropriate idiom to move into because of the sort of majesty of the chord movement.
Led Zeppelin was one of the bands that kind of created heavy metal. Whether you consider their music heavy metal or not, it certainly led the way for heavy metal. Are there things that you would like to and not like to take credit for in the bands that came after and were inspired in part by Zeppelin?
Well, you know, the inspiration or the lift, if you like, was multifaceted in many respects. So many drummers emulated John. And so many guitarists emulated Jimmy. And I'm sure that John Paul Jones's bass player, being what it was, was studied by bass players everywhere. So on a musical level, it was very flattering, I'm sure, for all the guys to see and to hear the way that people had taken their style and taken it into their own capability one way or another. And you did see a lot of guitarists leaning back. The whole style of presentation was... lifted, and that's fine, you know, that's absolutely fine. It's a great compliment, if you like. Also, it is quite simplistic. It's just full force rock and roll with some imaginative writing and some great displays of creativity and power. But the actual taking the music and the songs and then moving them around a little bit, you know, people take a little thread of this, that, and the other for mm-hmm. their own mm-hmm. benefit all through time. Now, I don't know too much about any of that, and I don't have an opinion one way or another because I think that the popular music as a mainstay of sort of pop culture is rather like a kind of thieving magpie. You know, the nuances of Led Zeppelin that they couldn't touch were the beautiful parts that were just unattainable, I guess.
Robert Plant recorded in 2004. Guess what his forthcoming CD is? A collaboration with bluegrass country singer Alison Krauss. Our hard rock and heavy metal series continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Other Side of the Bridge, a novel about sibling rivalry and youthful indiscretions, by Mary Lawson. From the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, two exemplars in the annals of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We talk with Steven Tyler and Joe Perry of Aerosmith. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The story behind the band Aerosmith parallels much of the larger story of hard rock, its achievements, and its most obnoxious excesses. We're going to hear from Aerosmith's lead singer and lyricist, Steven Tyler, and guitarist and songwriter, Joe Perry. Aerosmith's first hit, Dream On, was released in 1973. The 70s brought more hit records and stadium tours. Tyler and Perry also became famous for their drug and alcohol abuse, earning the nickname the Toxic Twins. It led to the temporary undoing of the band, but Aerosmith made an incredible comeback with the help of Rehab and the rap group Run DMC, which remade Aerosmith's Walk This Way into a hip-hop hit. In the early 90s, Aerosmith went on to greater success with hits like Janie's Got a Gun, Crazy, and Crying.
There was a time when I was so broken-hearted, love wasn't much of a friend of mine. The tables have turned, yeah. Calls me and then where's that party? That kind of love was the killing kind.
Crying!
I spoke with Steven Tyler and Joe Perry in 1997 after the publication of their memoir, Walk This Way. What was happening around you musically that you really liked and that influenced you when you started to form the sound of Aerosmith in the early 70s?
Well, that whole era for us was influenced by the English bands, I think, far more than what was going on in America. You know, there was all, obviously there was the Beatles and the Stones and then the Fleetwood Macs and all those bands, the Who that we used to see, Zeppelin, you know, that was all part of it.
Well, Stephen, did you feel more of an affinity early on with the Rolling Stones in part because of your physical resemblance to Mick Jagger?
I think that was part of it. But as Joe was saying, it's interesting how early on you heard all these songs on the radio. But as soon as I got to leave my house and went to the Academy of Music in New York City and saw the Stones and felt the energy and of people running up to the stage and it just put a different hat on the animal rock and roll. And it was something that I always thought I could do better. I would love to be a part of that insanity, that rush. That was pretty much it for me. But yeah, there was Major League Mick Jagger was the baddest boy on the block, and I loved him so much. And from the sweatshirts and the type of pants and Brian Jones and the blonde hair, and teardrop guitar, and the high heel boots, it was all something of an incredible fascination that I just wanted to get closer to.
Let me play one of your first hits from your first CD. This is Dream On that we're going to hear. This is a real big, you know, power ballad, power chords with a kind of ballad kind of song. And Stephen, you have a kind of, you know, high voice. And I'm wondering, when did you know what your voice was going to be, where it was? You talk about singing in a kind of gruffer voice early on before recognizing your own voice, your real voice.
You know, for myself, I heard my voice back, and it was too sweet, mm-hmm. and angelic for what I thought rock and roll should be. So I started singing like this, and the whole first album is "Get Yourself Cooler, Let's Have Low," and even "Dream On," I sang in that voice. I like that better. But you know, I didn't know the limits of my voice, and I'm still doing things in a studio that tell me what my voice can do just by pushing it and trying it. In the early days, I remember wanting to keep away from my Everly Brothers type harmonies and roots and Beach Boys things, and wanted to keep it more skimpy. But it wasn't until, you know, I threw the "Dream On," that falsetto type thing, that knocked me out. And I listened to it back. I was embarrassed by it, and then the reaction to people in the room was great. And I got to tell you that as far as a power ballad goes, we didn't know what those were, or was it coined or phrased that.
No, because this is one of the first. Yeah.
It was something that, of course, then the press took the piss out of us and had to say that it was something that was Zeppelin-esque, Stairway to Heaven-ish. And I still have an anger towards the press to this day that they would have to, you know, A-B us to all those different groups and the Stones, instead of listening to our music, which was way different. I might have looked like Mick a little bit, and Joe looked like Keith a little bit, but he plays guitar, it's what it is. I'm a lead singer, that's what it is. I would have rather they looked at it as a new kind of music that was coming out of Boston.
Well, let's hear "Dream On" from Aerosmith's first album.
Dream on.
you're just joining us, my guests are Joe Perry and Steven Tyler of Aerosmith. I know that you feel like your music was kind of given short shrift compared to the image of the band, and I'll take that as my cue to talk about the image of the band. Steven, I figure as the lead singer, you're the visual focus of the group more than anybody. You're the kind of center stage figure, so it's particularly important for you to have an onstage style, and I think that's particularly true in the era of the stadium concert, which is your era. So tell me a little bit about creating who you wanted to be on stage.
You know, it kind of created itself in that I couldn't just stand there when Joe and the guys were playing. It made me want to dance. I never had a particular style. I started out as being a drummer, so I had some sense of beat and time. And I used to have a tambourine before I had my scarves and my microphone stand and all that.
How 60s. Kinda,
yeah, really. And a fur vest. And it just, one thing led to another. And I remember being down at Sindori Imports right around the corner from the Fillmore East in the East Village and buying a couple scarves and hanging them on the mic stand. And as I say, from doing it for all the years, one thing leads to another and you kind of hang your hat on it. And instead, I hung my scarves. And that's just about it. You know, I like to dance, and I like flowy things, and I like to look like a peacock and strut around, and it kind of goes hand in hand with our style of music.
Another part of your visual style has been, you know, the open shirt, the bare chest. I just find it an interesting paradox that your image and the band's image, in a way, is a mix of like the real macho, and also something that would be considered very female. You know, like the scarves, you know, flowing garments, tight-fitting satin pants.
It's all very sexual, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and it's meant to be.
Very confusing.
See, I don't have any hair on my chest from my
exactly right.
You know, from
what?
From my this grass growing a playground trip here. You know, it's my Russian roots. And I have a very, you know, in today's men are from Mars and women are from Venus talking. You know, I've got a large feminine side, which I pay homage to because I love my sensory perception and I love my feeling and my passion so much so that I call that life itself as what most women have naturally, and their capabilities of birthing and my capabilities of songwriting and writing with myself and with others and creating. I think it just goes hand in hand. And so it's just grown from that.
I'll just point out, women can write songs too, but we'll let that go.
and don't they all?
Right. So, did you wear makeup too on stage? Lipstick?
Do I?
Have you?
It's interesting. You go right to lipstick.
Oh.
No, I'm more a rouge man. No, not lipstick, because mine are big enough. Already,
oh, that's
I don't need
true.
Any more accentuation there.
To accentuate the cheekbones?
No, I go to town on my eyes, and I used to paint a tear on, and I like to have fun up there, you know?
Well, you know, that whole era there in the late 60s and early 70s, the androgyny thing was really big, you know, with the English bands, too.
True,
you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody from the Stones on down was trespassing on that weird ground, you know?
Well, let me ask you, your images and the music itself were so kind of sexualized. Do you think, since it was mostly men in the audience earlier on, do you think there was like a homoerotic thing going on there, or that men wanted to be you?
I don't know. I never took it that far in thinkology. I just always thought that rock and roll, you know, when you love something, you don't question why others do too.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's got its roots in the whole blues thing. You know, I mean, it's like a lot of the posturing and chest puffing and all that the hard rockers do, it's direct. The roots are directly in blues. I mean, if you listen to a lot of the lyrics in blues, it's all like, I'm a man and I'm going to Chicago to find my woman and all that stuff. It's all, the roots are very close. So I think that it just kind of follows, you know. It's still about, you know, guys getting on stage and blowing a lot of hot air, you know.
Right.
So, you know, the rooster's standing there like fluffing his feathers, you know.
So what you're saying is the blues had a baby and they named it rock and roll.
That's it.
My guests are Steven Tyler and Joe Perry of Aerosmith. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guests are Joe Perry and Steven Tyler of Aerosmith. You know, in some ways, I think Aerosmith led the way in rock and roll excess, you know, sex, drugs. And I think, you know, that the band helped create, forgive me for saying this, some of the most unappealing images of rock stars as satyrs, as spoiled, as selfish, as excessive, destructive, sexist. And I'm wondering if you've reflected at all on your contribution to that image of rock and roll. And it's an image that I think a lot of bands reacted against. I think, you know, punk rock reacted against that. I think a lot of, like, roots rock and garage bands reacted against that.
The thing is, in that era, there were a lot of them. I mean, we were standing toe-to-toe with a lot of bands doing the same thing, you know. I mean, Zeppelin and... You know, a lot of the stuff that we did, we learned early on from the English bands how to do it. You know, who was it? Mott the Hoople? You know, smashing things and putting everything in the hotel room through the TV. It's quite a feat. Plus, it takes up time, you know. It gets pretty boring in those hotel rooms.
But doesn't it kind of disgust you in a way, that kind of behavior?
We don't do it anymore. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? It's like, it's pretty juvenile, you know, but it was, you know, back then it was fun to do, you know, we did it and it was...
That sense of how bad can you be is thrilling, you know, for
and
a
get
moment.
Away, and get away with it, you know, it's pretty, you know, you get in the car and go and the road manager's stuck paying for it, you know, but...
I think it's something that people go through in their life, most children do, rebellious young age of 6 to 9, but I think when you're doing drugs, it kind of keeps it going. You know, doing a lot of cocaine, some people say, is God's way of telling you you have too much money, especially when you're a rock and roller, and the money's coming in, and the women are there, and you're out on the road, and people are screaming, and you're going from town to town, and everything becomes a big blur, and you know, we did it to the max. I mean, my role models were Keith Richards. Early on, I would go see him, and I remember once I brought him, I gave him my Walther PPK for his birthday and a tab of methadone, and it was kind of like going to the Wailing Wall and paying homage to my God. And I never want to blame him for what I went through with my drugs. However, I lived the same lifestyle he did and, you know, I can't say unfortunately got caught up in it, because I wouldn't trade those years in for anything. I know it was hard to get out of it, you know, but we did.
You know, it's interesting that, I mean, you had really bad, you know, serious drug habits and I think did heroin among other drugs. And heroin is the kind of drug that doesn't exactly enhance the sex drive. And I know that you both had very hearty sexual appetites and fulfilled them every chance you could on the road. But I'm wondering how those two work together, you know, like heroin in conjunction with a really active sex life.
Well, interestingly enough, when you did the kind of drugs that I did, and I can speak for myself, I can only speak for myself, I didn't do as much, I wasn't as promiscuous as most people would think. Their vision of me gallivanting around the country, raping and pillaging everybody's daughter. It wasn't that. It was you really stay to yourself. You live in a bathroom. You live in your hotel room with the curtains drawn. And when I got sober is when I realized how much sex I had missed while I was actively using in my drug addiction. And as far as heroin goes, it also afforded me to be able to sleep a lot. And I think the heroin also keeps a lot of water in your flesh, retains, I mean, that's the upside. The downside is that, you know, it'll kill you in the end. And the reason a lot of people take heroin, from clergymen to whoever, is because it makes you feel good. And it's just it's realizing that is so hard, especially when you're in full-blown addiction. Using in spite of adverse consequences is how they define an addiction, and one never really sees that when they're in the heat of it.
Stephen, when you would pass out on stage because of drug use, would you be embarrassed about it afterwards, or like, what feeling would you have about it?
I remember one time in particular, I'd been up for a couple of days, and I had my usual double beefeater martini straight up before I went on stage, and it just hit me so strong by the third song that I was so dizzy that I fell down, I couldn't get up. And I was so embarrassed that I barely made it back to the drum riser, and I stretched my arms out to Tom Hamilton, who to this day thinks I was trying to take a swing at him, but saying, you know, help me, I got to get out of here. Very much embarrassed as I look back at it now. Back then, my brain said thought it was cool, because if you could, you know, if you fell down on stage, it was like, don't forget, I came from the era of the 60s where if you didn't take every drug in the room and couldn't walk out, or if you could, then you were cool. Believe it or not, that mentality, was rampant. But looking back today, you know, it's embarrassing. Of course it is. You know, I just lived for the excess.
We used to like to see how far we could push it. I mean, I can remember sitting there and going, let's see how far we can go. And that's what ended up killing us spirits and our creativity, because, like Stephen said, in the end, you know, you just stopped caring about anything else except getting high. And it was a game we used to play. We were really young. We used to bounce back. I was always amazed how much I could do. And then the next day, be able to play, or you know, how much I'd be able to drink and then go on stage and play. And it was a game, you know. And what we did was we lost the respect for the gift that we had, and for what a gift it is to be able to live our dream. As you know, the dream originally, our first drug was music. That was the thing that got us off and got us inspired and got us in the room to make music. And then when you start off partying like that, and then you kind of lose sight of it all, and every night, no matter what you do, the audience is going nuts. You know, we just totally disrespected everything that was, you know, that came our way, and so we lost it all. And that was it.
My guests are Joe Perry and Steven Tyler of Aerosmith. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Steven Tyler and Joe Perry of Aerosmith. When we left off, we were talking about the band's drug use and how it nearly ruined them. Tyler went into rehab in the 80s after the band staged an intervention. A record that really helped revive the career of the band was the Run DMC version of Walk This Way, which sampled Walk This Way and had a rap over it. And that was in 1986. Was that before or after the intervention?
That was after.
It was after. So you were straight.
It was before.
Oh.
Yeah, it was.
You sure?
Positive.
Huh.
Don't you remember being in the studio and being like, I remember the video. Remember the video?
Yeah. We were chipping, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they used us. We sampled the drums, and we were called by Rick Rubin and John Small and who actually did the video, but in the recording of, they took the drums, and then they asked Joe to come in and play on it. And thank God he brought the bass guitar.
No, he had one of the Beastie Boys go down to his apartment and bring a bass in.
Yeah,
I brought my guitar, and it was like, who's gonna play bass? Well, we don't know. So they sent out for a bass.
So Joe played both parts, and we sang, and so there wasn't as much sampling on that as there is done today, where they would have just taken, most of the song and vocals off and then just rapped to it.
So you actually, you re-performed it for the record.
Yes, we did, and it was a great moment. I mean, I look back at the video, and not only was it good for the band because we're pulling ourselves out of this hole, it's interesting. I wasn't in the doldrums of my addiction at the time. I remember doing a Dilaudid or something, but chipping and trying to be aware of...
We were trying to control it at that point.
So it wasn't a low point in our careers, but it was good for us because it brought us back to relevance on the radio with their picking of us, of using that song. And of course, the video itself was... knocking down the walls between black and white and between rock and roll and rap. And it was just, it was a perfect moment.
Stephen, in the Aerosmith book, you say that the Run DMC version of Walk This Way made Aerosmith look hip for a change. How do you think Aerosmith looked shortly before that?
Oh, we were over. I mean, we were definitely, on our knees at that point. The creativity, the drugs had put all creativity to sleep. And, that helped in coming around, and especially for myself in the rehab, when I clearly saw that, I couldn't write lyrics anymore and everything was a fog, and that I really started this to be a musician and try to be creative, and that the drugs that I loved so much were actually stealing it away. It was an epiphanous moment where, that, along with getting a commitment from the rest of the band and to do it together, was my strength.
Would you both talk about writing the original Walk This Way?
Well, I was listening to the Meters a lot in those days. And, we had a lot of a background in playing that R&B stuff. And so we had a couple of James Brown tunes under our belt. And like I said, I was listening to the Meters from New Orleans. And
it's the Neville Brothers group.
Yeah, and I was really liking that, that funky stuff, And I felt like, well, let's write something like that. So at a sound check in Hawaii, we started fooling around with that riff, and then we brought it back to New York, and we put it together as a song, And then and Stephen, it lit a fire under him, and why don't you tell him about the lyrics?
Oh, boy, that was, I recall, Record Plant on 48th Street or whatever. We were staying at the Ramada Inn, and I took a cab. It was time to do lyrics, and I had all my notes with me in the cab. Got out of the cab, went up to upstairs the Record Plant, and took my coat off and realized I left all the lyrics to the album in the cab. Ooh. And they were gone and lost forever. Jack Douglas said to me, we're doing vocals tonight for Walk This Way, And I did what I could. I ran upstairs to the top floor, went into the stairwell, went down three or four floors because it was, 11 o'clock at night, and all the businesses were closed where I could scream and yell and sing and put the track on again and tried to, exhume in my head as best I could what I had written. And I didn't have any paper. I had a pencil, and I wrote all the lyrics on the wall, probably of the fourth floor at the old Record Plant, and I went down and sang it that night. And the rest is history.
So were they the lyrics that you'd written on the cab? Or did you have to make up some new ones?
Oh, I had to make up a whole bunch more, but I mean, I had the gist of it.
So some cab driver knows what the original lyrics were, right?
Probably threw them in a garbage can.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Thanks a lot.
Steven Tyler and Joe Perry of Aerosmith, recorded in 1997. Our hard rock and heavy metal series continues through Labor Day, when we'll feature an interview with Alice Cooper. If you'd like to download podcasts of our show, go to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's Epic of the Founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our hard rock and heavy metal series continues with stars of Spinal Tap, a metal vocal coach, and we give Gene Simmons of Kiss another chance to tell me how boring I am. I can hardly wait. Join us for the next Fresh Air.